Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Sam Tracy. Today's talk, recorded live at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland, comes from Jeremy Conendike, the president of Refugees International. Mr. Conendike shares his perspective on the challenges facing international humanitarian law and points to how protections enshrined in the Geneva Conventions after World War II are under threat today. This program was recorded on October 15, 2024. It will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. We begin with an introduction from George Look, board president of the Midcoast Forum.
Our speaker today is Mr. Jeremy Conendike, who will be speaking on Refuge at Risk: Can Humanitarian Law Survive 21st Century Geopolitics? Jeremy Conendike is president of Refugees International. He is a committed humanitarian advocate and seasoned emergency operator and has served in senior appointments in two U.S. administrations and in a range of U.S. and overseas non-governmental organization leadership positions. Prior to joining Refugees International, Mr. Conendike served in the Biden administration as USAID, that's the U.S. Agency for International Development, their lead official for COVID-19. In that position, he oversaw the design and implementation of the administration's Global Vax Initiative and coordinated the U.S. government's global donations of hundreds of millions of vaccine doses. He later served as the administration's lead official for the global Mpox response. From 2013 to 2017, Mr. Conendike served in the Obama administration as the director of USAID's Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance, where he led the U.S. government responses to a very extensive array of international disasters. Between his administration appointments, Mr. Conendike worked as a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development, focusing on humanitarian response and pandemic preparedness research. Mr. Conendike has worked extensively in the humanitarian NGO sector, including with the American Refugee Committee, now ALITE, and as a policy director with Mercy Corps. He is currently a member of the World Health Organization's High-Level Independent Oversight and Advisory Committee, and has served as a U.S. representative to the board of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and as the U.S. representative and chair of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs Donor Support Group. Very impressive array of jobs, if I must say so. Jeremy, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you. I was going to give you my bio, but George has done that, so I will skip through that. But as you've heard, I've played a range of roles both in and out of government focused on humanitarian crises and refugee issues, with a little detour into pandemic preparedness and response. I now lead an organization called Refugees International. Refugees International is an organization that fights to uphold the rights and the well-being of refugees and forcibly displaced people, both around the world and here in the U.S. Uniquely in our field, we are not a service delivery organization. We are a policy and advocacy organization. So we advocate for policy solutions to refugee crises and displacement crises. As a former government official, and I know there are many government officials, former government officials here in the room, I understand, and I know that you understand, the importance of change at scale. And the way that you get change at scale ultimately is through policy solutions to end and address crises. And so that is what we work towards. So we do not have a field presence permanently in any country around the world. We do not take any money from governments. We do not take any money from the United Nations. And that enables us to be fully independent in how we approach policy problems, how we seek to hold governments to account for their behavior, and in general gives us a credibility that is quite unique in the sector in the issues that we work on and the solutions that we try to promote in advance. We were founded in the late 70s in that in a time of ferment in Southeast Asia that produced quite a few different humanitarian organizations, of which we were one. And our founder was a woman named Sue Morton, who was working and living in Southeast Asia and witnessing Vietnamese refugees fleeing Vietnam by the millions in small boats, witnessing the pushback of Cambodian refugees back into the killing fields of Cambodia by Thai border police, and recognizing that those were problems that needed policy solutions. And that, so she created Refugees International to be an organization that could work on problems like that, that could try to mobilize public opinion, create pressure to call on governments to act on these sorts of problems. And part of the origin story of Refugees International is a march from the Lincoln Memorial to the White House in 1979, led by some of our founders and Joan Baez, to call on President Carter to send the US Navy to rescue Vietnamese refugees who were fleeing in boats. To their surprise, Carter came down out of the White House and met with the protesters. Hard to imagine that happening in this day and age, but it was a different era. And he guaranteed on the spot that he would do that. And over the coming years, about a million Vietnamese refugees came to this country. And I think that gets to something really important about why welcoming refugees and displaced people is important and so fundamental to our national identity. Many of those refugees have gone on to do amazing things and contribute in amazing ways to this country. Ki Huy Quan, who won the Best Supporting Oscar a few years ago for his role in Everything Everywhere All at Once, came to this country as a refugee from Vietnam in that era. Stephanie Murphy, a former member of Congress who sat on the January 6th committee, came to this country as an infant, as a refugee in that era. One of the co-founders of LinkedIn, now one of the biggest social messaging or social media apps in the world, and one of the more benign ones, relatively speaking, came to this country as a refugee from Vietnam. So there's value in that, and that is part of what motivates and inspires us as an organization. But we're in a different era now, and what we have seen more recently is that sort of welcoming posture that we saw in that era from President Carter is really eroding. And it's not just eroding in the US, it's eroding across a lot of global north or high income countries, however you want to categorize them. But these countries that have long provided both the financial underpinnings and the diplomatic underpinnings of much of the global refugee infrastructure. And so on our issues, we face some of the most challenging contexts that we've ever seen for refugee and displacement advocacy. I want to start with a little bit of a history lesson on how we got the system that we have now, how it came out of the post-World War II era. Then I'm going to take a deep dive into how geopolitical challenges are straining both the Geneva Conventions and the Refugee Convention, which are really fundamental underpinnings of the work that we do and of humanitarian work more generally. And then after that depressing deep dive, I'm going to try to end on a constructive note by talking about where we might find some solutions to rebuild global political support for both of those vital instruments. So our work rests heavily on those two instruments in particular, the 1949 Geneva Conventions, which outlined steps for the legal conduct of war, including, importantly, steps for protecting civilians in war and steps for protecting and facilitating humanitarian aid to civilians in the midst of war. And the 1951 Refugee Conventions, which enshrined binding protections for people who have fled their country and crossed an international border in search of safety on the basis of persecution or violence. Both of these have evolved and been updated somewhat in the ensuing years, but the fundamental protections should be and hopefully will continue to be what they were in that era, which is an important legacy and lesson from World War II and that post-World War II period. I think it's really important as we think about the point in history when those instruments emerged to recognize that this as a lesson that the survivors of that World War II era tried to hand down to the world. They didn't come out of World War II, look back at the tactics that had been used in that war, and say, well, that worked, let's fight wars like that again. they said the opposite. They looked back, even the, you know, the winning sides looked back and said, that was a horrible, horrible way to fight a war. We should never do that again. There must be limits on how wars are fought in the future so that future generations do not fight wars like this again. And likewise, as Europe dealt with between 40 and 60 million refugees in the post-World War II era, which is an astonishing number, an astonishing share of Europe's overall population when you think about, you know, the total population of Europe at that time, they didn't look at that and say, we need to build walls. They looked at that and said, we need to build protections. And in 1951, established the Refugee Convention to enshrine those kinds of protections because they remembered what had happened during World War II when people seeking safety were turned away and returned to harm and often to persecution and death. And so they created the Refugee Convention as insurance against that sort of thing happening again. Both of those are now at risk. Those are moral landmarks from that post-World War II era left to us by that generation. And they're now at risk. And it's, I think, quite important, in my view, quite important in our view at Refugees International that we preserve and protect those fundamental instruments, because if we lose those, the human toll will be incalculable, and we will also lose this important legacy that those who survived and came out the other end of World War II have tried to bequeath to us. So I'm going to start with the Geneva Conventions, and I'm not going to cover the whole Geneva Conventions here because it's a huge document, and a lot of it has to do with military conduct vis-a-vis other militaries and prisoners of war, and that's not really my domain. But a lot of it focuses as well on protection of civilians and enabling humanitarian action. And that is very much my domain and the domain of Refugees International. I'm going to use the shorthand IHL, that stands for International Humanitarian Law, but that's just another way of referring to the body of law of which the Geneva Conventions are the most important part. So IHL, with respect to civilian protection, rests on three things, three fundamental principles: necessity, distinction, and proportionality. Necessity means if you're going to attack a target, it needs to be a military objective. So you cannot legally target a civilian target. That is banned under the Geneva Conventions. There has to be some sort of plausible military necessity to any military action. There's also a recognition baked into Geneva that war is messy, and that there's not a kind of, you can't have a clean division between military targets and some sort of civilian impact. So Geneva also establishes the principles of distinction and proportionality to try and delimit and put some guardrails around the level of human impact that a military action will have. So the principle of distinction means that it is incumbent on a fighting force to distinguish between what is military and civilian. You can't just fire at anything and say afterwards, well, we think there was a military target there. You have to know what you're shooting at. And you have to distinguish in terms of what you're targeting between what is civilian and what is military. And you have to assess the potential damage of a military action based on the principle of proportionality, so that the level of human damage that may occur incidentally in the course of the strike has to be somewhat proportional to the military value of what you are trying to strike. Different countries interpret this very differently, as you can imagine. There is not a hard algorithm for how you make those choices, but the general principle is that, well, and more than the general principle, the legal requirement under the Geneva Conventions is that a country must take all feasible precautions to maximally limit the amount of civilian harm as a byproduct of its military operations. And it must have some internal legal thresholds for how it makes these kinds of distinctions. And so, to give you one example of how that's worked in U.S. military conduct, during the battle for Mosul in 2016, to retake Mosul from ISIS, a military strike that the U.S. might conduct that was assessed to have the potential to kill more than 10 civilians needed to go up to the commander of Central Command, the four-star general who ran Central Command, to sign off on that level of potential civilian harm. So that's a very strong incentive if you're a soldier in the field to limit the civilian harm in what you're doing, because anything that you propose that is going to have a high rate of civilian casualties is going to go all the way up to a four-star general who's going to be checking your work. It's a pretty strong incentive to make sure you're getting it right. Along with that, there are special protections. There are special protections for certain kinds of facilities. So strikes on civilian infrastructure are prohibited. Strikes on and attacks on things like health facilities have very, very tight additional guardrails around them because of the special nature of health facilities. And there are prohibitions of certain tactics. So tactics like the besiegement or starvation of a civilian population, the use of human shields, the taking of hostages, all of these are prohibited flat out, regardless of any military necessity that might be claimed alongside them. So those are things that even if you know, military concocts a military justification for doing those things, they are still prohibited and flat out illegal. The Geneva Conventions also establish protections for humanitarian personnel and for relief operations. And so as a general principle under the Geneva Conventions, humanitarians are allowed to access a population in a conflict zone. They cannot be arbitrarily denied that access. So a government cannot, as say the government of Nigeria did in Biafra in 1968, or the government of Syria has done since 2012, try to just outright deny humanitarian access because in cases like that, part of their military strategy is the starvation of the population. That's an illegal tactic, and barring humanitarians on those grounds is likewise illegal under the Geneva Conventions. And it also provides special protections for humanitarian activity. Humanitarians cannot be targeted or struck, and are to be protected by fighting forces, and cannot be treated or viewed as combatants, even if what they are doing may run contrary to the military tactics that the government is trying to pursue, as has often been the case, for example, in Syria. The last critical thing to understand about these protections is they are not conditional. They don't depend on what the other side does. So when the US government was fighting ISIL in Mosul in 2016, we couldn't just throw these protections out the window because ISIL didn't respect them. And of course, ISIL didn't respect them, but we held ourselves to a different and a higher standard. The way that the Geneva Conventions work is they are directly obligatory on each belligerent individually. So you can't say, well, we're not going to do this because the other side's not. Then you're just both committing war crimes in that instance. And what we've seen over particularly the past decade is an absolute shredding of these obligations and increasing disregard and impunity for countries that ignore them and violate them. That current era kind of started, and you know, you can pick lots of examples over the years where these were violated, but I think the era we're in now really traces back to the origins of the civil war in Syria, starting around 2012. So the Assad regime felt no obligation whatsoever towards these legal requirements. It will claim it's following them. It is not. There's no real debate about that. And so we began to see in that civil war just gross, egregious violations of international humanitarian law, both in terms of violating protections on civilians and in terms of targeting of humanitarian operations. So the Assad regime, with a lot of support, it must be said, from Russia, the Assad regime pioneered really an era of total impunity for gross violations of humanitarian law. They targeted health facilities. Health professionals in opposition-held areas began actually building health facilities in bunkers and underground because so many times were above-ground health facilities struck by Syrian and Russian forces. The Syrian and Russian forces struck humanitarian sites, struck food distributions, struck UN convoys. They targeted entire apartment buildings. And if you've seen pictures of the town of Aleppo, which was the focus of a lot of the fighting, it looks a lot there like what the Russians did to Grozny in the late 90s in Chechnya. It is a wasteland, completely destroyed. And Syria largely got away with this. They are an international pariah, but Bashar al-Assad is not in prison. He's still in power. His regime still holds power. And Syria continues to fight, but much of the country is now a wasteland. I mean, and it underscores why this legacy of World War II is so important, because no country should want to either become or impose what has happened in what has been done in the Syrian civil war. And, you know, I said much of that involved Russia. Well, Russia then adopted some of those tactics when it initiated its war in Ukraine. And we've seen many of these same kind of violations in Ukraine to devastating human effect. So the Russian military has targeted civilian residences, conducted cruise missile strikes on apartment blocks, has struck aid convoys, has even, in numerous instances, conducted double-tap airstrikes on first responders. So they will conduct a missile strike or an airstrike of some kind, wait a little while until the first responders show up, the ambulances show up, and then they strike again. And when they are criticized about this, when the U.S. and other Western countries have been very critical of Putin's war in Ukraine and the tactics that the Russian military uses, Putin's response is basically that that IHL, the international humanitarian law, is basically just a geopolitical fig leaf, that it's all Western hypocrisy, that the U.S. doesn't really believe this, doesn't really uphold this, that criticisms about international humanitarian law are simply the U.S. using IHL not as a law to uphold, but as a political cudgel with which to beat up a geopolitical rival. So in other words, nothing's real, nothing really matters, it's all just a great game, and you can violate it at will, but fundamentally, it is not a protection, it is not a universal protection or a universal restraint on how wars should be fought. And in the post-COVID era, especially as the war in Ukraine got underway, that argument actually got a lot of traction around a lot of the world. Much of the world was quite infuriated about what they saw as Western hypocrisy on vaccine distribution, and was not necessarily predisposed to then show solidarity after feeling like they had not gotten solidarity from the West when in their hour of need. But it was still a complex picture. There were countries that stood up. For example, the Kenyan UN ambassador gave a really impassioned speech drawing on Kenya's own colonial history to argue why Russia's invasion of Ukraine was invalid. So there still was some credibility seen in these criticisms of what Russia was doing and the tactics it was using. And I think the U.S. in that period, in kind of the Ukraine war period, had an imperfect but still fundamentally defensible story to tell about its adherence to international humanitarian law. I think we take it seriously in our own wars, albeit very imperfectly, but seriously. Even when one of our partner countries in 2015 began a war in Yemen. So when the Saudis began a war in Yemen in 2015, they committed a lot of the same violations that Russia or Syria have committed. So the Saudi and Emirati military campaign used siege tactics, used starvation tactics, used double-tap strikes on civilians, targeted civilian sites and facilities, struck health facilities, so failed to exercise and adhere to the principles of distinction and proportionality. And I was in government at this time. It's when I was serving the Obama administration. I spent a lot of my time in 2015 and 2016 kind of waging an internal advocacy campaign along with other partners in the White House and other parts of the government to push the Obama administration to really put the screws to the Saudis on this, to try and restrain Saudi behavior, because we were in that time refueling some of the flights that were dropping these bombs. We were providing some of the weapons through arms sales. And we had leverage, and there was a strong desire not to use it. There were many at the State Department and the Defense Department who were very opposed to putting meaningful pressure on the Saudis. We were saying many of the right things, but we weren't following that through. They were ignoring them. They continued. And we spent about a year spinning our wheels, trying to get the Saudis to change behavior, mainly through the use of our rhetoric. And we made some headway with that. We did manage to break the blockade, that the naval blockade that Saudi Arabia had put on Yemen, which was threatening to starve Yemen's people. We were able to secure deliveries of food and fuel through both commercial and humanitarian means into Yemen through that blockade. But the civilian protection concerns did not improve. And the breaking point for the Obama administration finally came after the Saudis conducted a double tap airstrike on a funeral, and that killed 100 people, and that was finally the point where in October of 2016, the Obama administration initiated the process to suspend arms sales to Saudi Arabia until that behavior changed. Of course, then, a few months later, President Trump came in, he undid that, and the Saudis continued with that behavior for several more years. But it gave us at least some modicum of credibility, that we were willing to put some leverage on the table, albeit too late, too little, and given the political changes in the U.S., not as effective as we would have hoped. But what that also showed, and in fact there was a huge open letter signed by many of the senior officials in the Obama administration, many of whom are now currently serving in the Biden administration, basically saying, we did that wrong. We waited way too long to put pressure on. We were way too indulgent of the Saudis as they ignored everything that we were asking them to do. And we should have used our tactics, or we should have used our leverage much earlier than we did. You won't be surprised where I'm going next. The war in Gaza has really shredded what little bit of US credibility on this remained. We can talk further in the Q&A about the ins and outs of that war. I'm not going to do a deep dive on that now because it would take over the rest of the discussion. But what I will just say is what the rest of the world now sees in US policy is that leveling apartment blocks, using starvation tactics, things like that, is okay depending on which side does it. That was something where we could credibly, when it was the Saudis doing it and we were pushing back and we ultimately used US leverage, we could credibly say, no, we do take this seriously, we do uphold that. That's a much harder case to maintain in the eyes of the world now. What the world sees is basically a validation of Putin's argument. The world sees a validation of this idea that IHL is optional, that these protections, the protection of civilians, the protection of humanitarian workers, is optional. And whether it is enforced, whether it is upheld, is discretionary based on who is allied with whom and who's doing it to whom. And that is basically the death of international humanitarian law. If that is where we go, that is the death of international humanitarian law. If it's hard for the world to understand why leveling an apartment block is wrong in Kyiv or Kherson or Aleppo, but acceptable in Beirut or in Gaza City. And without getting into the deep legal arguments, which again, we can get into further later on if there's interest, that is what the world sees. And that is a fatal, fatal thing for the credibility and the viability of international humanitarian law. It's also, I think, a chilling preview of what we may see in future wars. Because if we are now in a world where wars are basically fought by Syria rules, by the rules of impunity, the rules of mass destruction of civilians, mass civilian harm, and importantly, of civilian harm as an explicit tactic of war to create pressure and leverage on a population, then we're in a very, very dangerous era to come, because that is exactly what the World War II generation was trying to tell us not to do again. It's going to also, of course, so, you know, with that worsening of the violence of wars, it is also going to produce a lot more displacement. And so there I want to turn to the Refugee Convention. The Refugee Convention, as I said, is one of the defining moral achievements of the post-World War II era. And it is under unprecedented strain today because of the level of global displacement that we have seen, particularly over the last 15 years. Let me start with just a couple of numbers on this. Total forced displacement globally, so refugees and internally displaced people and people displaced by climate and other factors, now stands at about 120 million people around the world. That is roughly equivalent to the population of Japan. The total number of global refugees in the world is about 43.4 million, about a third of that figure. And that is a population larger than the state of California. Those are the highest numbers that we've seen since World War II, and refugee numbers in particular have tripled just over the last 10 years. Within that, though, the majority are not refugees. The majority of displaced people do stay within their own country. About 67 million of the 120 million are displaced within their own country, what we call IDPs, or internally displaced people. And 75% of the refugees are in low and middle income countries, generally countries next to their own, so they cross the border and most of them stay in the first country where they flee. So that means that the low and middle income countries are carrying vastly the largest share of the global refugee burden. And you know, what this looks like on the ground is a place like Lebanon. In a place like Lebanon, one in every four people in Lebanon is a Syrian refugee. In Colombia, there are 3 million Venezuelans. Kenya has hosted refugees from Somalia and Sudan predominantly, as well as other countries, for decades. Pakistan has hosted Afghans in rising and falling numbers for decades. Now, to look at what that looks like in the US and other high-income countries. Well, if 3/4 of the world's refugees are in low and middle-income countries, only 1/4 are in wealthy countries. So the richest countries in the world with the highest GDPs and some of the highest populations are carrying the smallest share of the global refugee burden. In the US, we resettle a lot fewer during the Trump years, and then it's been rebuilt during the Biden administration. So we're going to hit around 100,000 refugees here this year. If we just call it 100K a year to keep the math easy and not think too much about what happens after November, so 100,000 refugees a year, at that rate, it would take us about 37 years to resettle as many people to the U.S. as there are Afghans in Pakistan right now. The total asylum backlog in the U.S., people waiting in adjudication on whether they can get asylum here, is about 2 million people. That is roughly as many refugees as there are in the country of Uganda, which is a country with 1/7 of our population and 1/76 of our GDP per capita. And yet this is a situation that is spurring a massive global backlash in Western countries. As we see more people seeking, as the global displacement crisis shows up increasingly at the borders of the US and Europe, even though we have vastly more resources to manage it, vastly larger populations than many of the largest refugee hosting countries, and frankly need more people to fill jobs and keep our economy afloat, most Western countries, not just the US, many European countries as well, are actually responding in a hostile way. We are tightening restrictions. We are putting up more barriers. We are not trying to scale our ability to welcome people to meet the scale of global need. We are, in fact, doing the opposite. And that is not lost on the countries that host 3/4 of the world's refugees. Because if refugees and displaced people are seen as a burden on this society, well, that sounds laughable to a country like Jordan, or a country like Lebanon, or a country like Colombia, or a country like Pakistan. And that is a very dangerous thing. Because in many of those countries, you know, they are not immune to the kinds of political pressures that we face here. And what they are seeing in US behavior and other countries' behavior is exactly the opposite of what we have been telling them and imploring them through our humanitarian diplomacy for decades. Every few years, Kenya would make some noise about wanting to expel Somalis back to Somalia, back to a war zone, back to an area of drought and occasional famine, and the US would pull out all the diplomatic stops to urge them not to do that. That's a much harder position to maintain now, because they look at what we're doing here, they look at us tightening and restricting access to asylum, they look at us making access to asylum functionally random and impossible for most people, and they say, well, gosh, if the US can do that when Venezuelans and Afghans and Somalis are showing up at their border, why should we do something different? And that's a very, very, that begins to undermine the solidarity on which global refugee protection rests. And that's a very dangerous place to be. I don't want to end on total doom and gloom, so let me point to a few things that I hope we can think about how we address some of this. What it fundamentally comes down to is we can't have it both ways on either of these issues. We need to be consistent. International law, whether it's refugee law or the Geneva Conventions, rests on universality. It rests on being good for the goose and good for the gander. It rests on countries upholding it when it's politically convenient and when it's politically inconvenient. And if we lose that, we lose it all. So how might we do that? When it comes to refugee and asylum flows, we actually have a pretty good model for how we could do this, and it's what we did for Ukraine. So when 4 million Ukrainians fled the early phase of the war in Ukraine into Europe, we didn't, as a global community, leave them all in tent camps in southern Poland. And you can imagine how chaotic it would have been if we'd done that. If we had treated Ukrainians the way that we treat, say, Afghans who cross or come to the southern border, they'd have been thrown into detention and they would have been given an individual screening to make sure each of them had an individually appropriate case for seeking protection in Western Europe. And you can imagine, you know, part of the reason why we have a 2 million person asylum backlog is because we don't have any way to look at a group of people and say on a prima facie basis, they probably have a good reason to flee what they're fleeing. If Kenya with Somalis or Turkey with Syrians had used the sort of system that we use here, it would have been total bureaucratic chaos, just as we're seeing, you know, in our own system now. So we need to adapt our asylum system to be able to scale to the scale of need. And maybe in the interest of time, I won't give all the details on how we would do that now, but a couple things that we could do. One would be to give more of a broad brush ability to access the United States to certain populations and who we can determine have an elevated basis for fleeing. So, you know, if someone is fleeing total social collapse in Venezuela or gender apartheid in Afghanistan, we should hold them to a different and a more flexible standard than we might someone who is fleeing from or trying to claim asylum from a country that is not at war, where there is not widespread, obvious and evident persecution. We don't have a way to do that right now in the US legal system. We also need to provide a lot more support to cities in the US. Part of what drives the toxic politics here is when a lot of migrants come to a city and there's no support for them. And it's a little bit like what would have happened in Turkey. If when Syrians were fleeing into Turkey, the Turkish government had just said to the towns along the border, well, tough luck, you're on your own, go deal with that. You can't expect a city to host refugees out of a municipal budget. But that's functionally what we do with asylum seekers here in the US. And we could build a different way of doing that that would be more supportive of cities, that would be make it more possible to host. In Colorado right now, rec center budgets are being cut because municipalities have to divert resources to asylum seekers. The federal government could be helping with that so that the community that is receiving people does not bear trade-offs, does not bear that kind of burden from that. We also need some different tools, particularly as climate migration increases, because it is getting harder and harder as people are forced from their homes by climate factors to fully determine who is a refugee based on the classical refugee definition. So we need to do some updating there of our systems to reckon with people who are maybe not a classical refugee, but also just objectively can't reasonably stay where they are, cannot continue to sustain a life in their own country. And on the Geneva Conventions, fundamentally, we need to uphold universality. We need to be willing here in the US, as now some European partner countries are beginning to do, to use the leverage that we have. We need to, you know, there's a certain irony in the fact that so many of the same US officials who belatedly said of the war in Yemen that we should have used our leverage with the Saudis much sooner are now part of an administration that is not doing that vis-a-vis Israeli military conduct in the war in Gaza and now the war in Lebanon. And I think regardless of your views on the justness of that war, or particularly maybe with added emphasis depending on your views of the justness of the war, the justness of a cause doesn't actually have any bearing on whether IHL applies. And if IHL can be waived because we really support a cause, if the US or any country supports a cause, then all we're saying is that IHL is optional. And that's a very dangerous place. So I think we need to ramp up leverage. We need to be willing to, as we did with the Saudis, even when it's painful, even when it's politically inconvenient, apply pressure, because rhetoric, as we've seen over and over, on its own does not get the job done. Fundamentally, in both those examples, preserving the Geneva Conventions, preserving the Refugee Convention, preserving civilian protection, and preserving the protections for people who flee their homes, all of that really rests on universality and solidarity. And if we lose that universality and solidarity, we're going to lose this important legacy that was passed down to us by the survivors of the Second World War, and that would be a huge and historic loss. But it doesn't have to be that way, and we can work to get a different outcome. And I will pause there. I'll end there. Thank you.
You've obviously given us an awful lot to think about. I always take while we're collecting the questions from the people attending here, I always take the opportunity to ask the first question myself. Given the history of mankind, isn't it a bit optimistic to think that all of a sudden we can impose these limits of war and people are going to follow them?
Well, look, if we lose our optimism, then we're in a pretty bad place. The origins of Geneva go back hundreds of years to the Battle of Solferino, which is the origin of the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement. And I think what we see in the ensuing centuries is that it is possible to restrain conduct in war. The U.S., again, as I said, imperfectly, but the U.S. does it. So during the Battle of Mosul in 2016, the battle to retake Mosul from ISIS. It's an interesting analog to Gaza because the population's about the same. It's about 2 million people. The size is about the same. It's about geographically half the size of the Gaza Strip. And the U.S. military in that instance, as I said, they had a very different threshold for assessing civilian harm. There were a lot of civilians killed, but far fewer than have been killed in Gaza, and far fewer still by the U.S. and the coalition military forces. Most of the people who were killed were actually killed by ISIL. And there was very tight coordination with humanitarian actors to make sure there was no, unlike the kind of adversarial relationship between or with humanitarian actors in the U.N. that we see in the case of the war in Gaza, there was very tight and close coordination between the U.S. military and the Iraqi military and the United Nations and NGOs. I was with USAID at the time, and I had a hand in leading some of that coordination. So it's possible to do it right. And I think that if we give in to pessimism, then we're kind of I think we're kind of validating that backward move. And I would just go back again to say that the victors in World War II, after going through what they went through, tried to leave us this legacy of saying, don't fight like this again. Don't do this again.
My goodness, we have a lot of questions here. I guess a number of questions basically asking, who's covered by the Geneva Convention? Is it only the nations who signed up to it? Is it all nations?
Yeah.
How does it apply to terrorists? Does it apply to civil wars?
Yeah. Yes.
Where does it apply? And so, why?
It does apply. So, all nations are bound by the Geneva Conventions. All or virtually all, certainly all kind of major countries have signed the Geneva Conventions. And there is some legal dispute, and there was, you may remember during the war in Iraq, there was some legal dispute in the US over how to approach that within our own legal system and whether the Geneva Conventions were only about state versus state conflict. They're not. They are also about conflicts within states. They do bind. They bind international conflict, and they bind subnational conflict. There are slightly different legal parameters in each, but the fundamentals that I talked about apply across all of those.
And then someone wants to know, ask that you give some examples of where international humanitarian law has curbed the behavior of people in the last 70 years, other than that of the U.S.
Yeah.
You used us as an example, but others?
I think the war in Syria is a really interesting case. It certainly did not curb Russian and Syrian military conduct, but it did impose humanitarian requirements on them that they would never have accepted otherwise. So in 2014, let me go back a bit earlier. Under international humanitarian law, as I said, a country cannot arbitrarily deny humanitarian access to a population in need. And from the earliest days of the civil war in Syria, that's exactly what the Syrian regime tried to do. They tried to block any humanitarian access to opposition-held parts of the country. And so the U.S. government made a legal determination that that was not lawful conduct by the Syrian government, and that aid could then go in. So we began funding U.S. NGOs to deliver aid cross-border from Turkey into opposition-held northern Syria in defiance of the Syrian government's obstruction. And we did that very much on the legal basis under the Geneva Conventions. The U.K. began doing the same. Several European governments began doing the same. And we established a very large aid operation that basically kept the population of northern Syria afloat at a time when the Syrian government was trying to besiege them and starve them out. In 2014, that was then adopted by the entire UN Security Council. So the UN Security Council, building on the precedent that we'd established there and building on the legal precedent from Geneva, issued Security Council Resolution 2165, which then authorized the UN and all legitimate aid agencies to operate aid into northern Syria. That barred the Syrian government from trying to veto it. The Syrian government wanted to be allowed to inspect everything that was going in, and the UN said, no, that is going to be an independent function, that Syria, as a belligerent party with a clear agenda of besiegement and starvation, was not going to be allowed to weaponize an inspections process in service of those war aims. And so there was an inspection process created, but it was applied or was executed by the UN. And we did something very similar a few years later with the Saudi blockade in Yemen.
Someone wants to know if it makes sense to think that countries should be able to accept refugees without limit. And if there should be limits, what are the limits and how do you deal with them?
This is one of the toughest, thorniest questions. And I think you have to start with the context that there is not an unlimited level of global displacement. So 120 million people globally forcibly displaced today, compared to 40 to 60 million just in Europe, just after World War II, at a time when the global population was about a quarter to a third of what it is now. These are manageable size problems if we choose to manage them. So without limit, no. I think there should be burden sharing. And again, I think what's fascinating here is to look at the way that Ukrainian displacement was handled. So 4 million Ukrainians fled their country. They weren't all left in Poland. The European Union and the US agreed to allocate and resettle Ukrainian refugees in just about every EU member state to share it. So Poland was not bearing that burden alone. And here in the US, we took many Ukrainian refugees. There might even be some up here in this part of Maine, I don't know. So there was a burden-sharing approach there. And there was not a limitless imposition on just the neighboring countries of Ukraine, because there was an approach to sharing the hosting of that population. And it was incredibly orderly, and it worked incredibly well. And it was very, very unique relative to what, say, Europe does with people coming across the Mediterranean, or we do with many of the same with many refugee populations that are trying to reach our southern border. So I don't think it's limitless, but I don't think it has to be limitless. Most people do not want to go that far from their homes. They want to, and most refugees, I mean, basically, almost any refugee that you speak to wants somehow, someday, if they can safely do so, to return home. And so the burden will not be limitless. And I think I want to call out some kind of bad faith, not from anyone in this room, but there is some bad faith rhetoric sometimes trying to play up the scale of global displacement to basically scare people into locking down borders. The former UK Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, was famous for this. She would, year on year, just try and find the biggest number she could and say, well, there are 35 million refugees in the world and they all want to come to the UK. And then, well, there are 120 million forcibly displaced in the world and they all want to come to the UK. And before she finally got booted out of office, she was over 700 million, which the math was really fuzzy, but it was some concoction of the full population of every country in the world that had any form of conflict whatsoever, and they all wanted to come to the UK. So we need to be aware of that kind of rhetorical game playing too. That, you know, when you hear those kind of numbers, it is an attempt to kind of scare the generosity, scare the welcoming out of you. And if we choose to manage the global refugee burden the way that we have worked to manage the Ukraine crisis, the mechanics are not the problem. The mechanics can be fixed. We just need the political will to address it.
And there are a couple of people who want to go back to some basics here. The question is twofold. One is, what is the basic definition of a refugee?
Sure.
And then how do you differentiate between asylum seekers and economic refugees?
So that first question is really easy, and the second question is trickier, so that's good. First question, what is a refugee? So as a legal matter, under the 51 Convention, a refugee is someone who has fled across an international border based on a well-founded fear of persecution, based on some aspect of their identity. It could be their social class, their political affiliation, their gender identity, their ethnic identity, their religious beliefs. And then that has been expanded over the years as the nature of, so that really came out of kind of how we understood the origins of refugees in World War II. And that has been expanded over the years to encompass the world that we see today, where often, you know, if you look at the Ukrainians again, not every Ukrainian was being persecuted on an individual basis in Ukraine on those grounds, but they were fleeing a situation of immense harm and widespread violence. And so there are now some additional instruments globally, one that covers the African continent called the OAU Refugee Convention, and another that covers the Americas, although not the U.S. does not recognize it, sadly, called the Cartagena Declaration. And both what those both do is expand the refugee definition to include people who are fleeing civil war and a mass social collapse and disorder, which is a lot of the refugee populations that we see in the Americas and in Africa. The difference between a refugee and an asylum seeker and an economic migrant. So in U.S. law, an asylum seeker has to be someone who would meet that kind of a refugee definition, that they are fleeing harm and would face harm if they were returned home to the country that they fled. And the parameters for that are outlined under U.S. law. And that can overlap with people who have other motivations to flee as well. And this is where it gets kind of tricky. It also gets tricky because in our immigration system now, that is about the only way that we have left for people to enter the United States, because there are so many restrictions on other forms of immigration. And so it has put more of a burden on the asylum system, because so many people now will claim asylum, whether they ultimately have a valid claim or not. And now, of the people in the asylum queue, roughly a third to a half will be successful in having a grounds to stay in the United States. So not everyone, but also not a trivial share.
I'm getting you into politics a bit, but not too much. How much would the bipartisan bill that Trump killed with his objections have helped our current immigration problem? Have you had a chance to look at that legislation?
Yeah, so the bipartisan bill had some good things and some things that I think are really pretty bad. So there were some good things in there. It would have adjusted the status of Afghans to give them asylum in the United States. So about 60 or 70,000 Afghans were brought to the U.S. after the fall of Kabul, evacuated here using an authority known as parole. That's different from asylum. Parole has to be renewed every 2 years. And it's very clear that those people will not be able to safely return to Afghanistan now or 2 years from now or 4 years from now. So there is a legal process called adjustment, which has to be passed by Congress. It was done for the Vietnamese in the 80s. That would convert them to an asylum status. That's been a huge fight for the Afghan American community and for the refugee community, and came very close to passing a few years ago. A couple of senators blocked it. I won't name them here, but you can look it up. And that would have been in the bill. That was taken out. That didn't go forward because the bill didn't pass. There was also an expansion of labor rights or labor access for asylum seekers. So right now, when someone comes here, if they go into that 2 million person asylum queue, they will be here for several years. And they have to wait at least 6 months to apply for the right to legally work. And it generally takes longer for them to even get that. And so you can imagine the burden that places on their communities. when you listen to what mayors in this country are saying, part of what they're complaining about is we have all these open jobs, we have all these migrants here who could fill these jobs, and they can't legally do it because they're blocked by U.S. law from applying. And that, of course, adds to the burden on cities. So it would have changed that. It would have shortened that to 30 days. So there were some good things in that bill. But what it also would have done is enshrine in legislation much of what the Biden administration has since tried to do through executive order, which has really destroyed any sort of consistent or reliable access to protection for people who do truly need it through our asylum system. Right now, if someone, I've interviewed Afghans and Somalis who are in detention here in the United States, who would be fully recognized as a refugee by us in another setting. So if you're that Afghan family and you have no way, you can't stay in Afghanistan, you can't stay in Pakistan, Pakistan is kicking Afghans back to Afghanistan right now, so you try to come to the United States. To get an appointment at the border, you have to stay in southern Mexico, often for 6 to 8 months, often being extorted by cartels, waiting for an appointment through a cell phone app that is not available in any Afghan language. So hopefully you speak English or can pay someone to translate for you. And if you don't get an appointment today, you apply tomorrow, and you apply, and you apply. And there is no prioritization of protection needs in how those appointments are allocated. So someone with no valid protection claim and someone fleeing direct harm face an equal access to that system. So it randomizes access to asylum, and it has also made it much more restrictive. There are only about 1,650 appointments per day along the whole of the U.S. southern border through that app, and that is the only way to seek asylum at the U.S. southern border right now. To put that in context, when Ukrainians were trying to come in, at a single port of entry, we managed to process 1,100 in a day. So there are better options than that sort of a legal setup. But as long as we are trying to kind of deter our way out of this challenge, rather than just accept that it is a large-scale challenge that we need to manage at the scale we face, I think we're going to continue to be caught in this sort of political fix.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. We learned a lot.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a talk by Jeremy Conendike, the president of Refugees International. It was recorded at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can also find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Sam Tracy. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.